this session is by Stan Zygmunt, and he will talk to us about the scientific endeavor and the whole person.
Thanks very much. I'm really excited to be with you here today to share one of my favorite and most challenging teaching assignments, a junior-senior level course for science majors at Valparaiso University called The Scientific Endeavor. The course I teach descended with some modification from a course designed over 25 years ago by my good friends Gil Cook of the chemistry department and Bob Manweiler of the physics and astronomy department. In the process of teaching this course 10 times, I've made it my own, but the most recent 2018 syllabus still bears a distinct resemblance to the original 1992 version. Oh, here it is. The course is designed as a capstone experience that invites students majoring in natural science disciplines to reflect on the nature and character of science, its competence and limitations, how it progresses, and how in the hands of human practitioners it sometimes takes wrong turns. Because of the subject matter, the scientific endeavor has much more in common with a traditional course in philosophy of science than with a disciplinary course full of specialized science content. For the same reason, my course is a challenge to students and teacher alike because it's largely discussion-based and relies upon a pedagogical format that differs significantly from what's used in most of the other courses my students are taking. At the beginning of the semester, as in all my courses, I identify myself as a Christian who's very interested in the relationship of my faith to the science I enjoy so much. I also mention that we'll have several opportunities during the semester to discuss such possible relationships. You can see from the syllabus that the course is divided into two sections. The first begins with the nature of science and involves issues raised in the philosophy of science. Thomas Kuhn's Structure of Scientific Revolutions plays a central role in this part of the course. Del Ratch's Science and Its Limits contains a very helpful guide to both Kuhn and his contemporary critics from a Christian perspective. We go on from there to consider a series of case studies of prominent scientific discoveries, such as the overthrow of the phlogiston theory, the discovery of the neutrino, the development of special and general theories of relativity, and the solution of the structure of DNA. Selections from Theory of Science by George Gale, The Double Helix by James Watson, and The Golem by Harry Collins and Trevor Pinch give helpful and in some cases provocative historical accounts. Serious reflections on the various case studies allows my students and I to ask how well these events fit the models of scientific methodology and progress championed by both traditional and contemporary views. In this context, we also consider several examples of what we can see in hindsight as wrong turns in the history of science, known by the labels of pathological science or pseudoscience. The second part of the course is devoted to topics that fall under the heading of science and the whole person. Prominent among these are ethical considerations that arise in the course of scientific work, as well as examples of alleged scientific misconduct. The publication On Being a Scientist, put out by the National Academy of Sciences, is a great resource for us in this part of the course. We wrap up the semester by discussing the ways that scientific work and claims intersect with our various faith commitments. This includes some reflection on science as a possible vocation for a person of faith. In this part of the course, we read the last three chapters of Del Ratch's book, as well as several chapters from John Polkinghorne's One World, The Interaction of Science and Theology. Well, the students who take my course are generally junior and senior year natural science majors, along with a few engineering students. Recently, they've been about equally divided between students who are planning to attend graduate or professional programs and students who intend to teach science in secondary schools. In fact, currently, the course is a required course for secondary science education majors. During the semester, I give essay-based midterm and final exams and require students to turn in written reading responses of 1 to 2 pages for nearly every class period. My hope is that taking the time to state their responses to questions that I use as prompts will prime the pump for class discussion on that day. In addition, there are two major writing assignments in the course. The first is a 10 to 15 page overview and analysis of a scientific episode students choose from their own discipline. This is a chance for them to more deeply investigate a discovery or revolution in a field they care about and test to see whether the events match the models for scientific change described by various schools of philosophy of science. The second is a shorter and more personal essay near the end of the course that asks students to discuss a specific area of real or potential conflict that arises when ethical or theological perspectives are brought to bear on issues they may encounter in their intended careers in science or related fields. At the beginning of the semester, I try to generate interest in Thomas Kuhn's work by telling them that his Structure of Scientific Revolutions, published, by the way, in the year I was born, is without a doubt the most influential 20th century contribution to the philosophy of science. I also tell them that it's a truly controversial work that most of their science professors have never read. I hope you don't mind me taking an informal poll in this audience. First of all, how many of you are current or former college or university faculty? Raise your hands. Okay, all right, thanks. And then how many of you have read Kuhn's book? Okay, so maybe about a third to a half, something like that. And that's probably maybe a little bit overrepresented in this audience. But my claim that most of their other professors in science areas have not read Kuhn's book piques their interest, although many of them find Kuhn's ideas to be pretty difficult to wrap their minds around. Assisted by Del Ratch's commentary in his book, students consider Kuhn's challenges to the traditional conception of science as being rational, empirical, and objective. One of the most thought-provoking ideas advanced by Kuhn is the notion of a paradigm, an overarching philosophical and theoretical framework of a scientific discipline within which theories, laws, and the experiments performed to test them are formulated and interpreted by the members of that disciplinary community. Kuhn articulated a model for what he called a scientific revolution, the process by which a scientific community in the end, rejects one paradigm in favor of a new one. Once a community agrees on a shared paradigm, Kuhn's model for scientific change involves periods of normal science, encounters of anomalies, a crisis state, and eventually the completion of a scientific revolution. One of Kuhn's controversial claims, among others, is that the paradigm so strongly controls the way science is done that the process of scientific observation is not a neutral, objective activity, but is in fact colored by the paradigm in such a way that two observers operating within different paradigms can actually see different things when looking at the same event or phenomenon. This claim is often summarized by the statement that all data are theory-laden. It has a strongly idealist flavor that rankles many practicing scientists whose scientific training usually assumes that observation is based on reliable sense perception that leads to the same data for all observers. Those of you who teach classes with discussion components know how difficult it can be to motivate and inspire interest in your students. I find this doubly difficult in my course, which is generally populated by students whose science courses have much more traditional lecture formats. So in order to illustrate the influence of observer expectation on the nature of perception, and hopefully to generate lively classroom discussion, I'd like to show two video clips related to this concept. They serve as visual prompts for my students, and I have found them far more effective than relying solely on their responses to Kuhn and the other texts that I assign. The first is a recreation of the classic 1949 experiment by Brunner and Postman, in which slides depicting a series of playing cards were shown with very short exposure times, beginning at 10 milliseconds, and viewers were asked to report which cards they saw. If the cards were reported incorrectly, the exposure time was gradually increased, if necessary, up to a maximum of 1 second. So I'm going to play the link right here and let you take a look at this. Okay, slower this time. Mm-hmm. Okay, out loud, right? Everybody together. Seven of spades, ace of diamonds, nine of clubs. Oh, I didn't hear everybody say the same thing. Yeah. Okay, so in this example, you can see that the observer is conditioned by his or her prior knowledge that playing cards come in four distinct suits with well-defined shapes and colors. These form a conceptual framework that's similar in many ways to elements of a scientific paradigm. Brunner and Postman found in their work that nearly all of their subjects, when seeing a short exposure of an incongruous card, right, like a red six of spades, initially report an erroneous result. Either they say six of spades or they say six of hearts, depending on whether their perception is color-bound or form-bound. Many subjects eventually were able to correctly identify the incongruous cards when the exposure time reached a larger value, but more than half of them experienced what Brunner and Postman called disruption, a perceptual confusion that persisted even at long exposure times. It's often manifested, or it was in their work, by comments like, "I don't know what that card is." In his thinking about observation, Kuhn was heavily influenced by knowing about this experiment, and he commented on it at length in his Structure of Scientific Revolutions. A different but related example of the way in which an observer's expectations influence the results of observation was offered in 1999 by Daniel Simons and Christopher Chabris, this time in the form of a different video clip. They asked viewers, and you're going to have this assignment in a minute, to count the number of times a team of three white-shirted basketball players passed the ball to one another in a time of slightly less than 1 minute. And sometimes when I do this, I set it up by saying, which is not really the case, but I'll say, well, some people think that men and women tend to get different answers when they try to accomplish this observational task. So here, you're counting, remember, how many basketball passes there are among the three people that are wearing the white t-shirts. Okay, so how many passes did you count? Let's see. How many said 13? Raise your hands. 14? 15? 16? More? Okay, all right. The correct answer is 15. But did you see the gorilla? Watch it again here. Watch it again here. As an aside, I want to mention that the first time I saw this video was when it was used by my pastor as a sermon illustration on Sunday morning, showing once again that going to church sometimes leads to unlikely benefits. It's a great video. Repeated showing of the video, Simons and Chabris found that about 50% of the viewers do not report seeing the gorilla at all. In fact, many of them express astonishment and disbelief, and I heard a few exclamations like that, when they see the video again and realize what they missed. Simons and Chabris refer to this phenomenon as inattentional blindness, a failure to report an unexpected object or phenomenon due to engagement in a primary observational task. One might call this an example of straining out basketballs but swallowing gorillas. Once again, it shows how the prior commitments or expectations of the observer influence what he or she actually reports as data. Both of these short exercises generate a great deal of student discussion about the reliability and limitations of observations in general. I'd like to guide their discussion toward imagining how these kinds of limitations can be manifested in their own scientific observations. Well, I hope you find this all very interesting, but you might be wondering just what does all this have to do with a faith perspective in a science classroom? Well, one characteristic of natural science mentioned in nearly all accounts of the scientific method is that it's tentative and subject to continual testing and revision. Related to this is one of the necessary elements of the scientific attitude that Ratch mentions in his book, Intellectual Humility. Kuhn's claim that a paradigm exerts an important influence on the very nature of observation itself provides strong motivation for me to cultivate humility. This lesson fits nicely with and reinforces my Christian understanding of my limitations as a finite and fallen creature. In the last part of the course, when intersections of science and faith commitments are discussed more explicitly, discussion often centers on possible tensions between Christian faith and other religious views and a modern scientific worldview. During these discussions, I like to offer some of the insights provided by philosophers of science that I think can help students, and maybe their professors, negotiate these tensions and possible conflicts. As I've already mentioned, Kuhn's discussion of a scientific paradigm focuses on its composition, what elements it's made of. According to Kuhn, a scientific paradigm includes agreement by its adherents about what problems are relevant and worthy of study, what predictions are made by the reigning theory or theories, what kinds of experiments and equipment are legitimate and useful, and how the results of those experiments should be interpreted. One of the more controversial aspects of Kuhn's model is the way he stresses the wholesale and radical discontinuity involved in a paradigm shift, almost as if every element of an old paradigm is rejected by its successor. Imre Lakatos, a Hungarian philosopher of mathematics and science, was critical of Kuhn's views. In contrast to Kuhn's notion of a paradigm, Lakatos claimed that scientists actually work within what he called a research program. In his 1976 book, Proofs and Conjectures, Lakatos expanded on his earlier PhD dissertation and described a research program as consisting of a hard core surrounded by belts or layers of auxiliary hypotheses or mini-theories, as shown on this cartoon slide. In this way, Lakatos focused more attention than Kuhn on the structure of the scientific belief system used by actual practitioners. The hard core and auxiliary hypotheses differ in the degree of commitment that we have to them, and also, therefore, in their vulnerability to change, perhaps in response to new observations or discoveries. In this way, Lakatos also discussed the dynamics of a research program by considering the way it responded to potential evidence that challenged some of its claims or hypotheses. According to his view, a research program could either be progressive or degenerating over time, depending on its ability to respond to challenges in ways that either increased or decreased its empirical adequacy. Lakatos suggested that a rational scientist will eventually abandon a degenerating research program in favor of a more progressive challenger. The kind of structure that he described, I believe, is similar to the idea of a noetic structure that all human beings have. And this idea was discussed at some length in Plantinga and Walterstorff's book, Faith and Rationality, Reason and Belief in God. Interestingly enough, I was first introduced to the idea of a noetic structure by reading an article written by longtime ASA member J.P. Moreland called The Rationality of Belief in Inerrancy back when I was a graduate student. Basically, our noetic structure is the set of all beliefs we hold along with the relationships that exist between these beliefs. This web-like structure, illustrated by the network map shown here, includes some core beliefs that we hold very tightly that are foundational for us and therefore very resistant to change. These are the kinds of things that we would only abandon on the basis of truly spectacular and persistent contrary evidence. More peripheral are theories or beliefs we hold more tentatively and loosely. These are more vulnerable to contrary empirical evidence and could be abandoned or modified relatively easily without threatening any of our hardcore beliefs. Such a description of a scientific paradigm or research program is also a useful model for beliefs that we hold in the theological realm. At least I think it is. When I suggest this to my students, we usually have some lively discussion about what beliefs they would consider to be part of their own hardcore and which ones are more auxiliary and peripheral. I think this sort of discussion gives my students new tools and approaches for dealing constructively with challenges they encounter to their faith, whether they're scientific or religious challenges. In particular, I'm thinking of a student who arrives at the university with a strong religious background, which has given him very definite views on not just the central elements of Christian faith, but on many other areas that some of us might consider more peripheral, and in which Christian communities throughout the ages have displayed considerable diversity. I hope this part of my course gives this student a constructive way to respond to challenges that he encounters to some of the long-cherished beliefs he's inherited from his upbringing. For example, armed with insights provided by philosophy of science, he might, under certain circumstances, be able to reevaluate and perhaps modify some of his beliefs about the distant past, for example, the origin of human life, or the future, the sequence of events leading up to the return of Christ, without feeling any threat to his commitment to the fundamentals of the faith. In one of my recent end-of-semester evaluations, a student wrote that his favorite expression I used in the course was, "You don't have to throw out the baby with the bathwater." And I believe it came from our discussion during this part of the course. Well, I hope that I've given you a little bit of food for thought in considering your own belief structure. I invite you to consider which of your own beliefs, whether they're scientific or theological, are in this hardcore region, those things that are resistant to change, and which beliefs, by contrast, are less certain and more open to reevaluation and perhaps modification. And for those of you who are educators, whether in the church or in the academy, I hope I've given you some ideas for how you might handle faith-related issues in your own teaching. Thanks very much for your attention. I welcome any suggestions that you have for me to use in my own teaching, and I'd be glad to try to answer any questions you have.
Thanks for your talk. I've heard the name of Thomas Kuhn a few times during this conference already. So maybe your poll of us means that more of us, in fact, being here at the conference, are familiar with him. But it's always good to be reminded of him so we can again remind our students. One of the things when I first encountered the book was that it was written to the social sciences. So within social sciences versus the natural sciences, do you have any students or colleagues who comment on its applicability to things like astronomy and other things like that? I think it fits, but you're more of an expert, so I'd like to hear from you.
Just to be sure, you're asking whether I hear from my colleagues or from students?
Those of us who are in the more physical science area, I realize that ESA involved both.
Yeah. Well, as I read Kuhn's book, I mean, Kuhn, of course, was trained as a physicist, right? And when he wrote the book, it was really, it was based on a series of lectures that he gave back in the late 50s. The book was published in 1962. And Kuhn, first of all, is not a very good writer. He's not, if you're used to reading books by philosophers, they write terse, crisp stuff that's really, you know, very dense, but there's not much fluff. And Kuhn is almost like he's capturing his thoughts on paper. And it's meandering, there's a lot of repetition, it's a little difficult to drag students through. But what I like about it is that he's, you know, he's kind of meditating on his own thoughts, especially looking at certain chapters in the history of science. So although I think it's correct that his book has been appropriated a lot by people in the social sciences, it was actually written almost wholly based on his observations about natural science episodes. Yeah.
So as you talk about Kuhn, and I'm thinking, well, first of all, my thought is, how do you put all this in this class? Because I don't want to do something similar, but I don't have time to get to what you do, but that's a different question.
It's a frequent response from student evaluations that there's too much. And just to be sure, I put pictures of those books up there. Yeah. With the exception of Kuhn's book, we really just read selections from all the other ones.
And maybe it gets a little bit of a question. Do you do anything, because Kuhn's been around a while, anything critiqued,
yep.
And do you do much with the critiques or others who have followed in Kuhn? I know, like, a name that crossed my mind that ran across recently in Boston Cross or something like that. Does that come out at all in your course as well? Because there are some good critiques of them, too.
Right, yep. Some of those critiques are summarized by Del Ratch in his book, and that's a really helpful guide to have someone read along with Kuhn, because he not only his book functions like a Cliff's Notes for Kuhn, but also then he summarizes what the responses have been to Kuhn since the early 60s, and although he doesn't go into extensive detail by that, he talks about some of the challenges and how Kuhn's views by contemporary philosophers of science are regarded as kind of oversold, overblown a little bit. And Kuhn himself kind of retreated a little bit from some of the more radical claims that he felt people misunderstood what he was trying to say. Yeah, so the Del Ratch's book really helps in that regard of trying to summarize some of the contemporary views that were how far people have come since Kuhn. Yeah.
This core periphery idea is something I thought a lot about with respect to our different denominations. And what is the core and what is the periphery? That seems to me to be the key question about the different denominations. So how would you apply your ideas to us talking with each other about our denominations, but also between science and our congregations at home? How can you help us think about this core versus periphery? How should we address those sorts of ideas?
Wow, that's a great question, and ultimately that's kind of the application of these models. I think in trying to help us go beyond just debates or discussions where we talk past one another is to realize that we share as believers we share this common core of what C.S. Lewis would call mere Christianity, and then you've got differences among Christian traditions and communities throughout the ages. On issues like the ordinances, right? Do we baptize infants? Do we baptize adults? And how do we administer the Lord's Supper and all of these things? And to realize, though, that some of those issues are less central than others, and that I can have fellowship with other believers whose church traditions may place them in a different way of administering those things without threat to those things that we hold in common. And I think it helps promote discussion, and that could be with people in my own church on issues like the antiquity of the earth or the origin of human life, if I can help them see that some of these issues are more peripheral than others, and therefore to call them into question is not questioning the fundamentals of the faith. So I don't know if that really answers your question, but that I think that's what I'm trying to accomplish for my students, and give them tools and ways of thinking about their belief system that allows them to have discussion without feeling like any question is a challenge or a threat to who they are as a person.
Do you find students sort of are holding some of their beliefs more loosely after you do this network?
That's a great question, and like Sarah mentioned too, I have not done any kind of extensive post-class, pre-post survey of my students, but I really want to start doing that to find out, how some exposure to some of these ideas does affect their own views. Yeah. I would hope so, but I don't know.
All right, let's thank Daisy and Sarah and Stan for a really stimulating session. I don't know about you, but I want to rush back to my computer and revise my syllabi for the fall. So.